Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. As usual, I feel tremendously honored and blessed to be with all of you. I want to keep sharing this out because Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers and I are still getting numerous invitations to preach across the country and, frankly, at this point, across the world as well. And so if you're interested in bringing the both of us to your parish, and we're striving to do this at little to no cost to parishes, so please reach out. We would love to come and be a part of your parish and to bring the gospel in a sense of revival in the gospel. Reach out events@deaconharold.com or events@drmarcuspeter.com. Now, for this hour, we're going to begin by talking about conscience in Virginia. Newly released texts show that Dr. Anthony Fauci privately told colleagues that a reaction some people had after their second COVID-19 vaccine dose theoretically could be associated with miscarriage in the first trimester. Days later, he told the public that 10,000 pregnant women had received COVID-19 vaccines without any concerning safety signals being detected. No red flags were his words. Andrew Picciotti Baer joins us to talk about a court order that's coming out of the Virginia courts, and why this falls well within the purview of conscience considerations. After that, we will talk with Jennifer Hartley. Mary's Meals is a global movement supported by people from many walks of life and different backgrounds, and their mission is to enable people to offer their money, good skills, time, or prayer through involvement to the work that Mary's Meals does. And then we will talk with Dr. Andrew Kubik. Democratic Governor Maura Healey recently signed a bill allowing abortion at any point in pregnancy in the state of Massachusetts, making it the 11th state to impose no limits on abortion. Andrew joins us to talk about just how egregious an issue this is and what an affront this is to human dignity and why we as Christians cannot just rest on our laurels, that we ought to make our voices heard. And then for the remainder of the hour, the last segment, I want to talk about a new film produced that's being put out at the end of August in theaters nearby. Please look it up. It has to do with the story of Blessed Stanley Rother. The film comes to theaters at the end of August. I believe it's August 25th and 26th in English and August 27th in Spanish. Blessed Stanley Rother is one of those saints that we ought to pay attention to. He is a saint for our day. For now, the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Wednesday, August 19th. It's the Feast of St. John Eudes. And today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. President Trump is hosting an event with tech leaders at the White House. An official said the event is meant to strengthen America's innovative and technological dominance. Political Report's prediction market companies will not be a part of the event after previous reports said executives from the companies would be in attendance. The event is being used as a kickoff for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission Innovative Advisory Committee, which is set to hold its first meeting tomorrow. President Trump has nominated White House aide Heidi Overton to head the Food and Drug Administration. In a post on Truth Social, Trump said Overton has been a rock star in his administration and is known to take on the hardest issues. Overton is currently the Deputy Director of White House Domestic Policy Council and will fill a seat vacated early this year by former Commissioner Marty McCary. Her nomination is being hailed by some conservatives, though one former Trump health official told Axios that she has no real experience running anything. And new research shows eating nuts daily can help keep blood pressure in check. The data published in the British Journal of Nutrition shows eating a handful of nuts each day is associated with 20% lower risk of developing high blood pressure. The research, which involves 8 studies, does not link nuts to directly preventing high blood pressure. Nuts contain a lot of nutrients, including fiber, plant-based protein, and vitamins E, K, C, and B. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Andrew Pichotte-Bear joins us today to talk about Virginia's COVID-19 vaccine folly. Andrea is legal analyst for EWTN News and director of the Conscience Project. Follow her work at conscience-project.org and at Bea Pichotte on X. Andrea, so great to speak with you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Marcus. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. It wasn't too long ago, and you and I had off-the-air conversations about this on and off, about the vaccine situation and just generally COVID-19. And so on the air, we've discussed this as faithfully as we could. And so much information is coming out now about Anthony Fauci and what he knew and what he didn't know. So share with us this recent issue pertaining to no red flags for women in the first trimester of pregnancy.
Well, you know, that really is an interesting issue, and I think that you're right in saying that prudence really requires us to be cautious about what Dr. Fauci said and what he didn't say to people. But the clear standard is not whether the vaccine put women at a higher risk or not. We just don't have the data. We don't have the data, but the assurances that there was no question is something that I think has really thrown into question whether public health officials are being completely forthright. And what I think that the implications of a lot of that are is that we can really, I guess, have a better understanding of people's religious and moral considerations in looking at things related to public health, whether it be vaccines or any other kind of mandatory things that are going on. And there's a case, Marcus, that I kind of stumbled across in my own home state of Virginia, where the University of Virginia's health programs, they're a large hospital chain, they required all of their employees to have the vaccine. They did have a mechanism for religious exemptions, and my state is very good at allowing parents the right to exempt on religious grounds from childhood vaccinations in schools. But they created kind of a very problematic system for granting exemptions. And their system is really almost, when you read it out loud, you think, this is crazy. It was, if the employee had an objection and they were members of a particular church that had voiced an objection, then they would get an automatic waiver from the vaccine. If they were members of a church or attended a church that didn't have a clear formal policy against the vaccine, then they were put to kind of an individual committee looking at their exemption request. And when the rubber hit the road, most people that were sent to that committee didn't get an exemption. And pulling this kind of outside of the context of outside the context of vaccines and into the context of religious freedom, we can really see that having an official policy is what gets you identified as a sincerely held religious belief against something really is problematic. And we can see that as Catholics, because some Catholics object on religious grounds to the COVID vaccine and some, like myself, don't. And so we really need to be very clear about that we allow for religious exemptions, but that we don't, we make sure that they're tied to the individual conscience and not any kind of denominational affiliation.
I'm really glad to hear you talk about this, because I wanted to ask, what what constitutes that list? And what happens, like you already alluded to this, what happens if you don't fall within the bounds of that list?
Yeah, no, it's really, really problematic. Fortunately, a number of employees of this healthcare system, they filed a lawsuit, and their group was certified as a class of aggrieved people who were in, you know, religious affiliations that didn't have a formal policy, and they either were fired or denied an exemption based on their sincerely held religious beliefs objecting to the vaccine. So, you know, it will be a very important test as the case is evaluated in the federal court, as whether this idea of a disfavored religion is an unfair treatment among religions, where the right is really an individual right. It's not a church-owned right.
Share with me about this whole concept of a disfavored religions clause, and what ought we to understand from this case in Virginia?
I think it really does show us that sometimes for expediency purposes, mm-hmm. and because administrators don't really understand how faith works, faith is individually held, that sometimes, you know, you get a system in place that, let's just assume, you know, there were good intentions, but it was unworkable, and it ended up being under-inclusive, right? It wasn't giving the legal protections for all the people that wanted to exercise them. And that's just an important reminder for us as people of faith, that whether it's in the context of vaccine waivers or even issues regarding, like, military chaplaincies being kind of considered fungible with other mental health support services, we're dealing with a culture that's becoming less and less tethered to formal religious identity, mm-hmm. and that makes it very important for us as believers to explain why we can't just be, you know, sent to a group counseling, but we need the sacraments. And in the context of what service men and women are facing, or if it comes for a religious accommodation or an exemption, we're going to have to often explain what our faith teaches and why we've come to a well-reasoned conscience objection.
And thereby also the respect of the fact that within this well-reasoned conscience exemption, this is not only well within the constitutional right of an individual, it is also well within the God-given right of the individual, and that the state has to recognize its limitation thereof.
Yes, no, absolutely. And this is the other thing. When it comes to religious freedom, these are rights that God has given and that the state should recognize and safeguard. But it's not to the state to decide. Now, obviously, religious freedom isn't carte blanche, right? There are going to be times where genuine health and safety requires rules that don't allow for exemptions, right? We can think of, you know, the most kind of clear example is child sacrifice. Mm-hmm. You know, we can come up with criminal laws against child sacrifice, even if there are still religious communities that might endorse that somewhere, because it's for the common good. But at the same time, we can't use this idea of the common good or public health and safety to kind of run roughshod when allowing for exemptions or accommodations really don't impact the greater good. And instead, I think it's important that we think that individual rights and common good do not have to be pitted against one another. And our role as Americans is really to see that the law sees that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. We're running out of time. Just very quickly, how does Title VII, religious accommodation rules, factor into this conversation?
Yeah, no, this is key. And this is where the Supreme Court's recent cases on Title VII, which allows, this is the civil rights law affecting discrimination in the workplace, it protects religious belief. And the Supreme Court has said it used to be that an employer could kind of ignore an accommodation if there was anything above a de minimis impact. Now they need to really make more accommodations. And the idea is we should be able to allow our workforce to be able to contribute to the economy, contribute to the good, without having to leave their faith behind.
Andrea, as usual, tremendously blessed that you're keeping abreast of all these issues and informing us of them. Thank you for your time and your wisdom.
Thanks, Marcus. Have a great afternoon.
I've been talking with Andrea Picciotti-Bear. She's a dear friend, and she and I have been talking about Virginia and a lot of the folly pertaining to prudential judgment and the COVID-19 vaccine. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Brought to you by the nonprofit Seton Home Study.
Hi, everybody. Dr. Ray Guarendi here. You want to pass the Catholic faith on to your children? A very good way is to teach your children at home. You want to protect your kids from the toxic culture that surrounds us? Do you want to have a greater influence in what your kids are learning? Once more, a great way is to teach your children at home. No teacher is going to care about your kids as much as you do. Seton Home Study School is the best way to teach your children at home. Go to setonhome.org. setonhome.org.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
As Catholics, it's not always easy to share our faith with others. As a St. Paul Center member, you'll have access to a growing library of online scripture and theology content with Scott Hahn, John Bergsma, and other leading scholars to help you encounter Christ in scripture and empower you to share your faith confidently. Know Christ, share Christ. Get started free at stpaulcenter.com/ave. That's stpaulcenter.com/ave. Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I was looking at the gospel readings today, and particularly the gospel reading comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 20, verses 1 to 16. Jesus tells a parable of the kingdom of heaven like a landowner who went out at dawn to hire laborers for his vineyard. And he agrees for usual daily wages. And that had me thinking about the reality of generosity, because if you read the narrative, there are those who've been laboring for the Lord, or in this case, laboring within the vineyard, with a reluctance to give that which to give up that which they've been given in terms of a privilege. And joining me to have a conversation, particularly about sacrifice for the sake of those who are lesser fortunate, is Jennifer Hartley. Jennifer Hartley runs Mary's Meals, a global movement supported by people of many walks of life and different backgrounds to enable people to offer money, good skill, time, or prayer to help those suffering the effects of extreme poverty in the world's poorest communities. Jennifer, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. Thank you for having us. It's a pleasure to be on your show. What an amazing show you've had already today, too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I want to begin by just giving you the space to share about Mary's Meals. And just imagine that our listeners don't know about it. Just share with them the amazing work that's being done by Mary's Meals.
Thank you. Thank you for that opportunity. So Mary's Meals, we were founded in 2002 by Magnus McFarland Barrow, and he was actually a salmon fisherman and was doing good in the world all around, and there was a huge hunger crisis in Malawi, and he met this young boy named Edward, who his father had passed, and his mother was also on the floor passing away, and Magnus had this beautiful opportunity to ask Edward, who was the son, who's 14, what would be next in his life. And he said, my goodness, if I could have a meal and an education, then I could take care of my siblings. That's all he wanted at 14, was just a meal and an education. And Magnus stopped in his tracks, and he thought, my goodness, the Blessed Mother must be talking to me right now. And he took that challenge and that gift that he was given, and we started feeding 200 children in 2002. And today we feed over 3 million in 16 of the poorest countries around the world. The most beautiful thing about this mission is how simple it is, because every child that gets a meal has to go to school to get that meal. So we're trying to change their trajectory in life and give them hope and dignity and just bring brightness into it. And I can just tell you, I got to see it firsthand most recently about 3 weeks ago. I was in Malawi, and that happens to be one of the countries that we have the feeding program in. We feed over 1.3 million children in Malawi. And if you don't know this, Malawi happens to be, I think it's the sixth poorest country in the world. Mm-hmm. And I went to 6-7 different schools and met so many wonderful children. And that cup of porridge that they get is life-changing for them because they want to go to school because they know they're going to get a meal. And the whole program's run on volunteerism. So the cooks and the parents, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, they volunteer to help serve the children because they know their children are going to get fed, and that might be the only meal they get. $25.20 will feed a child from the United States for an entire school year because of the volunteerism. It's just an amazing mission. And Mary's Meals is, we know we've been in the United States for over 14 years, but not many people know about us, and we're really trying to drive a movement across the United States, leaning into our faith and leaning in. God has really put us in a beautiful position to share his gifts in life, and he's leaning on us to make a difference.
Can you share with us? So everyone who's listening right now is undoubtedly moved by what you do, and why specifically Malawi? And then clearly you do work in other countries as well, so share with us about that. But secondly, how can people get involved? Everything is done by means of volunteering, so how can people get involved?
Right. So we are in 16 of the poorest countries, so just to help you with that, Malawi happens to be one of the largest feeding programs mm-hmm. we have. But to get involved with Mary's Meals, it's very simple. All you have to do is go on marysmills.org, and we have all kinds of information on our website, from volunteering to supporting as a supporter, a donor, if you will. The 2520 feeds a child for an entire year, but we have this new program that we're introducing, and it's called Feed a School. And I love this program because it is so closely aligned, and where I lean into it is children feeding children. So schools, parishes, individuals, groups of friends can go in and they can decide they want to sponsor a school and how many other children are in that school. We have them all on our website, and they can make that personal decision. When you sponsor school, you're really connected to it. You're totally tied. You get the school report. You get pictures of the children. You understand what the population of that school is, what their grade point average is, how they're moving through the organization from that school. I happen to have a school in Zambia, and I'm trying to get one in Malawi. That's one that just touched my heart. I left my heart in Malawi, and I just, it really means a lot. But the school program, if you think about Habitat for Humanity, you can go build a home for someone. Well, you can feed anywhere from 170 children to how many. I visited some schools that had over 4,800 students in a primary school. That's how desperate they are. So you can, marysmills.org will take you right there, and you can find everything about it. We do local volunteerism around, we're the fundraising arm for Mary's Mills. So we do have 16 affiliate countries, but we see Mary's Mills in the UK to help them with all the feeding programs because they do the operation side of it. We're the funding side of it.
So for everyone listening right now, what are ways in which from here in the United States they can get involved?
So you can get involved with doing any of... So you can join... We would love to have you join as a volunteer or an ambassador, and we would work with you around the different... Depending upon the state that you're in, we would be reaching out to you. We have all kinds of conferences. We have training programs. They can personally set up their own volunteer fundraising page. They could be a part of any of the events that we do. They could personally donate if they felt like, gosh, I don't have the time to volunteer, but I'd like to donate. They can donate personally from that. They can bring their friends and family, do walks, runs. We just did a 5K run. We have a 5K run happening in Ohio in November. We've got a concert in Ohio that is happening in September, September 19th. We also have a conference in Iowa that is happening at the end, I think it's September 25th. So we've got quite a few things. You can find those on our website as well. And we would be happy to reach out to you. Anybody that wants to get involved will personally contact you. We are a smaller organization that is driving the movement across the United States.
Well, thank you so much for making the time to share with us, Jennifer.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having us on and sharing in the wisdom of God's work. So thank you so much. Have a blessed evening.
You too. God bless you. I've been talking with Jennifer Hartley. Jennifer is the executive director of Mary's Meals. And as she's been mentioning, this is a global movement supported by people from across the world, different backgrounds. And they are right now serving in 16 of the poorest nations on the planet. And these are made up of people who are completely volunteers, offering money, goods, skills, time, prayer. And between feeding programs and also resource programs and also ways in which children can receive more safety, especially in tenuous government circumstances. So find out more, marysmeals.org, and find out how you can get involved. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
This program is brought to you in part by Dave Tyson with Real Estate for Life, a faith-based organization, and Texana Bank, offering residential mortgage assistance across all 50 states, including purchases and refinances with conventional FHA and VA loans. More information can be found at re4l.org. Again, that's re4l.org.
All loans subject to credit approval. Texana Bank, NMLS 407536, Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
You know, maybe we need to ask ourselves, do we really know Jesus? Maybe another way to ask that would be, how familiar are you with the Gospels? When I was living in D.C., I was on the plane taking a late flight home, sitting next to a young girl. She was probably 16, 17. I had my collar on, and we got talking, and she said, somehow in the course of the conversation, she acknowledged that she was running away from home. and was in the midst of an awful lot of difficulties that were going on. Her story seemed to be remarkably akin to the story of the prodigal son, which we just heard this past Sunday at Mass, huh? And so I started to speak a little bit about that with her. And I said, you sound a little bit like the younger son in the story of the prodigal son. And she looked at me like I was from Mars. And I said, are you not familiar with the story of the prodigal son? And she says, no, never heard it. And I just looked at her and I says, oh my goodness, are you in for a wonderful evening?
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What is criticism exactly? If you pay close attention, do you notice what most criticism is? Oh, it's not because you're doing something wrong or hurtful, something that needs corrected. Most criticism is, you're not doing it the way I would do it. Or you're not doing it the way I want you to do it. That's what most criticism is. And you have to get good at sorting that out. Otherwise, you're going to get real upset when anyone says anything about what you are doing. Now, of course, you could turn this on yourself. Do you do that? Is most of your criticism a message to someone else that says, you're not doing it the way I would do it? Well, save your criticism for things that are really wrong.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My dear friend Dr. Andrew Kubik joins us right now. Democratic Governor Maura Healey signed a bill allowing abortion at any point in pregnancy in the state of Massachusetts. This is now the 11th state to impose precisely, this is not virtually, this is truly no limits on the termination of life in the womb, even up to the point of partial birth. Dr. Andrew Kubik is a Catholic bioethicist. He is a teacher and faculty mentor of bioethics at St. John Paul, the Great Catholic High School, ethics consultant at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, senior research fellow for public policy at the Catholic Healthcare Leadership Alliance, and adjunct instructor of bioethics at the Catholic Institute of Technology and the University of Mary. Andrew, my friend, great to speak with you again. How are you?
It's good to speak with you as well, Marcus.
So, doubtless, your heart sank to your knees when you saw the news as well. And I just want to ask you before we talk about the issue itself to share your concern as a Catholic man, but also as a husband, as a father, about just how terrible this reality is and the fact that we have 11 states now moving in this direction.
Well, I think you offered a very important and concise introduction into this abhorrent legislative act. And not only as a husband and as a father, as a Catholic, as just a brother or sister, as a essentially a family member, as part of the human family of these little children who are dying deaths that I would never want to describe on your radio program. It breaks your heart. It causes your heart to sink. And really watching the signing of this bill into law and seeing the applause around the governor as she signed it, it was just absolutely heartbreaking.
So this is a woman, a Christian woman, surrounded by other women, and all the women are cheering. Yes. For nothing other than the brutal tearing limb from limb of children, their children, at their most vulnerable stage of life. Something in society has gone horribly wrong, Andrew.
I think it has. I think it's been sadly building up to this point, and I really shudder to think where it goes from here. But we have lost a sense, and I encourage any of your listeners to read John Paul II's encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, on the Gospel of Life. And he talks about what is leading to, now he wrote it in the 90s, but he knew exactly what was taking place at the time and what was to come. And he mentioned about how we lost sight of our relationship with God. We have perverted the notion of freedom, where we live by way of license rather than actually freely exercising our will so that we act according to the way God has designed us to act. And we've lost our fraternity with one another. And that to me has been instrumental into where we have devolved right now, where we find ourselves.
So let's talk about the extent of the case here. Let's talk about the legislation that was signed on August the 10th and what it means in very practical ways.
Sure, certainly. Well, you mentioned that there are only 10 states in Washington, D.C. that have allowed abortion after 22 or 24 weeks. That makes the United States only one of 8 countries in the entire world that allows abortion, at least in some of its states, up until the point of birth. And that's precisely what this means, Marcus. This bill, as along with others that have been passed in the United States, allows a woman and her doctor to decide whether or not it is within the woman's best interest, whether it's regarding health, or we've seen with cases throughout the last few decades, health is broadly defined, but whether it's in the woman's best interest to take the life of that child all the way up into the last few remaining days of that pregnancy.
And the fact that we are seeing an overt push from society in approval of this tells us that we have massive anthropological problems as well. The non-recognition of the dignity of the life in the womb.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, just kind of going through some documents and just doing some reading before we have our conversation right now, just reading some of the information or misinformation, falsehoods that are out there. You know, one of the documents I was reading talking about what processes, again, I would not share with your listeners, that take place in order to take the child's life, refer to the child in the womb as pregnancy tissue. So completely rejecting the very humanity of that child as he or she is growing in his or her mother's womb. Another one talks about how it's uterine tissue. So we have now completely removed any sense of humanity. As a culture, we've removed any sense of humanity away from that little breathing child, that little child in the womb exercising its limbs, having a heartbeat, having brain waves that are recordable, etc. We've completely divorced any sense of humanity from that child.
Can you share with us some of the statements that Maura Healey made about this horrible legislation? And of course, like you've rightly mentioned, couching it in euphemistic and particular political narratives.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think it's important to recognize because the name of this bill is meant to, and it's meant to well up within all of us, within all people of goodwill, support for it. The name of the bill is Prioritizing Patient Access to Care Act. Now think about how that completely clouds or covers over the reality of what's taking place. We want people to access care, but at no point is care taking the life of an innocent human being, whether it's in the womb or outside of the womb. And so this bill was specifically designed to respond to, and the way it's written, to respond to women who need, quote unquote, need an abortion for their health. And what I want to emphasize to your listeners is that Holy Mother Church cares desperately about the health of that mother as well as the health of that child. And at no point in a mother's gestational journey and throughout her pregnancy is it necessary to safeguard her health to directly terminate her child's life. There's actually, and I really encourage your listeners to look, there's something called the Dublin Declaration on Maternal Health Care. And over 1,000 healthcare professionals, researchers, et cetera, who deal specifically with the child in the womb and the health of the mother and her pregnancy, et cetera, say, and I'm going to quote it here, as experienced practitioners and researchers in obstetrics and gynecology, we affirm that direct abortion is not medically necessary to save the life of a woman. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to be able to respond to how this bill has been couched, how it's been phrased or named, to say, absolutely, we care about the health of that mother, but we also recognize that there is not a circumstance in which that child's life has to be directly taken.
So, Andrew, we have verified medical statements, verified medical research to affirm this very clear reality that at no point is an abortion a necessary move to safeguard the life of the mother. And at the same time, we also have enough data to prove that, especially as of 15 weeks that we know of, a child feels tremendous pain in the womb. The data is out there. This is not gestational tissue or uterine tissue. So in order to get the legislation like this passed, we quite literally have to turn a blind eye to pre-existing science.
Mm-hmm. I think we do. I think, unfortunately, and in my home state of Virginia, we see this coming November a ballot initiative to make abortion a constitutionally protected act here in the Commonwealth. I think that we have to invest our time, and God willing, we hear it also at the pulpit in the churches as well. We hear it, we read about it in the news, et cetera, but we do have to take the time to fully understand what the actions that are actually being carried out here or perpetrated. Because when there's euphemisms, too often we get confused or miss the reality of what's really taking place.
Andrew, my friend, thank you. I know how hard this is to talk about, but your stalwart fortitude is so crucial. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcus.
My guest has been Dr. Andrew Kubik. He's teacher, faculty, mentor at numerous institutions. He's been talking with us about Massachusetts becoming the 11th state with no abortion limits, signed by Governor Healey. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This Ave Maria program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit.
One of the greatest threats to your family isn't a disaster or a virus, but addiction. In nearly every family and every pew, someone is silently struggling. Beginning July 11th, Shalom World TV and the iThirst Initiative present Unshackled, a powerful new series on the Catholic Church's response to the addiction crisis, bringing together leading voices to discuss real healing. Stream it free at shalomworld.org or on the Shalom World app today.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
This communion with Jesus and with one another, that being united to Him and abiding in Him, that is the indispensable condition for bearing fruit. That's why our Lord says back in John 15, verse 5, apart from me, you can do nothing. If you're not united to Christ, you're not going to do anything for Him. So communion with Jesus, our Savior, focusing on Him and getting to know Him and be known by Him, that is what makes it possible for us to bear fruit as Christians. And communion with others is the most magnificent fruit that the branches can give. That's one of the things that He's looking for from us, that we have a communion with one another, that we have a love and a concern. Does it mean we agree with one another? Not necessarily.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Who belongs to the Catholic Church? According to the Catholic Catechism, all men and women are called to the Catholic unity of the people of God. In different ways, they belong or are ordered to belong. The Catholic faithful, other believers in Christ, and all mankind are called by God's grace to salvation. those who in faith accept all the precepts, sacraments, and all the means of salvation given to the church and possess the Spirit of Christ are fully incorporated into the society of the church. One, however, who does not persevere in charity is not saved. He or she remains in the bosom of the church, in its body, but not in its heart. The church is joined in many ways to other faiths that call themselves Christian, even though they do not profess the Catholic faith in its entirety or have not preserved unity or communion under the successors of Peter. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pete. I'm blessed to be joined by Maria Scapolanda. Now, Fathom Entertainments, they're going to release a movie called American Martyr, the Stanley Rother story. This is exclusively going to the theaters nationwide for two nights only in English. This is from August the 25th to the 26th, and in one night only in Spanish on August the 27th. Maria Scapolanda is the promoter of the canonization cause for Blessed Stanley Rother. She's also an award-winning Catholic author and journalist, and her books have explored the lives of the saints, missionaries, and other inspiring figures of the faith. She's most recently the author of The Shepherd Who Didn't Run, Blessed Stanley Rother, Martyr from Oklahoma. And this is her book. I'm blessed to be able to be joined by her again. Maria, it's so great to speak with you again. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's good to reconnect with you, and you clearly did a tremendous amount of work with regard to Father Stanley Rother's life. And so I want to invite you to just share a brief overview about this enigmatic but also deeply significant man.
Stanley Rother was born on a farm in Okarchee, Oklahoma. Okarchee is a town just northwest of Oklahoma City on the west side of the state, and everything that he was living as a child became important for him when he became the missionary that went to Guatemala. It's kind of incredible when you think about the facts that he was a farmer from a farming family centered on faith, the church, family. And when he got to Guatemala, he became the missionary who was one with the people there. And even in the fact that they were farmers, and they are farmers, that's what they do for a living, is farm. So he could get out there and talk shop with them. And he also was in a community that centered on the faith, that big church that is in the middle of town in Santiago, and obviously on the family and how important it was to be community. They are the Mayan Zutu Hill on a volcanic lake called Lake Atitlan. They speak a language that only two villages in the whole world speak. And Father Stan, the man who was sent home from the first seminary because he couldn't learn Latin and speak in Latin, became the man who not only learned Spanish, but also this extremely rare Zutu Hill Mayan language. I kind of see it as his first miracle, or maybe just God gracing him, showering him with what he needed so that he could really serve the people there fully. He knew how important the language is, and just 5 years in, he was the only missionary able to celebrate Mass in Zutu Hill for them. It was really, God prepared him, even though he didn't know that that's what was going on. How's that for a beginning?
Oh, that's beautiful. And in fact, I'm glad you touched on it, because one important thing about Blessed Stanley Rother, Father Stanley Rother, that we can all acknowledge is we can make the mistake of thinking that this was a man, or most saints, I guess, we can make the mistake of thinking that they're brilliant, they're academic, they're scholastic. Mm-hmm. No one would look at Stanley Rother and think that. And don't get me wrong, he was brilliant in different ways. He just wasn't what you would consider a scholastic type. And yet, here he is, by the grace of the Holy Spirit, becoming a master at a language and a dialect solely for the purpose of bringing souls to Jesus. Can you share with us that reality, that there was a certain genius to him, but also his deep heart that drove him for evangelization, for the salvation of souls?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah, you get it. That's exactly what stands out for me. The fact that we've called him ordinary in the past, in the sense that he's no MVP. He wasn't the best at really anything. He was a young man who said yes to Jesus and to his call to the priesthood and to serve the people wherever God sent him. And he began in Oklahoma for 5 years, but then when he volunteered for the mission, he was there 13 years. And truly, he's a saint that I can relate to because he is one that was a day-to-day priest, a diocesan priest, just being a parish priest that would stand for the people in all the ways that that meant, in celebrating the Mass, the number of sacramental celebrations they did is really like in the hundreds. He was there for a reason. And in my book, when I think of the whole picture and what he really accomplished, it was bringing the image of Jesus, of a God who loved them, to a people that had been forgotten for a long time. In one of his letters, for example, he wrote his prayer, and he asked the people in Oklahoma to pray for them as missionaries, and especially for him. And he said, "Pray for us that we may be a sign of the love of Christ for our people." And he lived that every day. Really, his martyrdom I see as one final step in this commitment to be a sign of the love of Christ for the people there.
Share with us how much he sacrificed for the sake of the mission he undertook.
We call him a martyr, and I think the people there knew it from the moment that he was killed in the rectory. It was a time of a lot of violence, not just in Guatemala, but really in all of Central America. There were agents of military from all sides, and the people were caught kind of in the middle. And he was not a political guy. He was not an academic, like you said. So he was just a practical man who wanted to be present to them. And he did help in every way he could think of to protect them, meaning opening the church at night so that the people who were afraid could go in there and sleep under that protection. But really, he was a shepherd, a guy who wanted to keep being for the people and with the people. When he was put on a death list by all these military agents that were around them, it was when his associate pastor was also put on the death list that he decided that he needed to go home and bring him to Oklahoma to be safe. We're talking about late 80s. He was already being targeted, but in our late 70s, and in 1981 is when he did come in January back to Oklahoma with his associate pastor. Then he had to decide whether he was going to go back or not. And I call that in the book and in really in speaking about him, his Gethsemane. He really had many talks with God and with his family, with his friends, with his bishops. What do you want me to do? And he could have stayed in Oklahoma and been a great priest here. They needed him here too. But it came down to saying, I promised the people that I would be there for Holy Week, and that's what I'm going to do. And he did. And that was just a few months before he was murdered. Being with the people, that sign of the love of Christ for the people, that's what called him to do what he did.
Maria, we've got about a little over 2 minutes left in the segment. Everyone listening right now, we've got a lot of saints we can look at and thank the Lord for this great armada, this great cloud of witnesses, as the scriptures calls them. Why should we pay attention to Stanley Rother? What is his role and significance in our life today? What can we learn from him?
Yeah, absolutely. We need saints that are local. We need saints that are contemporary. And he is very contemporary. You know, his siblings are still around, his nephews, nieces. You can talk to a lot of people who knew him. You can go where he walked here in Oklahoma. We have a beautiful shrine that you can come visit and go on pilgrimage. We need them to be saints that we can relate to. And honestly, for me, it began as a book project, you know, a great person that I wanted everyone to know. But this documentary that's coming out next week is like one more way that we're trying to just get the word out there that this is a shepherd to a people, but I am a shepherd to people here too. And he gives me the desire and the example of how to live that life. And it is simply by saying yes to every little thing as the day goes by. And in a letter that final year, he says, if it is my destiny that I should give my life here, then so be it. The shepherd cannot run at the first sign of danger. And that is Stanley Rother in a nutshell. I want everyone to get to know him, put him in your posse of saints that we can call on.
Maria, as usual, a joy. Thank you for this very well-researched but also deeply heartfelt book. I've been talking with Maria Scapolana. She is the author of The Shepherd Who Didn't Run, Father Stanley Rother, Martyr from Oklahoma. And the reason why we're talking with her is because Fathom Entertainment is releasing a new movie, American Martyr, The Stanley Rother Story, exclusively in theaters nationwide for 2 nights only. In English, August the 25th to the 26th. In Spanish, August 27th. And Christians, let's show up not only in support of Blessed Stanley Rother, but also for good Christian media to be put forth to reshape and evangelize the culture. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Thank you, Marcus.